This is a special podcast on WQXR.org. I'm Graham Parker, the Vice President of WQXR. The season-long impasse between the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and its striking players' union has brought one of that community's proudest institutions to the brink of extinction. Board members voted to suspend the remainder of the orchestra's season in February after negotiations broke down. Major doubts have been raised about next season. The sticking points are salaries, pensions, and health benefits, as well as the entire redefinition of their jobs to include more education activities. The strike raises the very real question of an orchestra's value to its community, particularly one that's endured the tough times that Detroit has. In a moment, we'll speak with two experts about the evolving role of orchestras in their communities and whether supply has outstripped demand. But first, joining us on the line is Mark Stryker, the arts and entertainment reporter at the Detroit Free Press. Mark, you recently reported the surprising news that fundraising is doing fairly well this season. How come that is?
It's an interesting case. The answer is basically that there are people that value the orchestra, and there are people that see a future in this institution, despite the dramatically difficult times that it's been through and it continues to go through. So there are still people out there that are giving the institution, even though the orchestra has been on strike. Fundraisers and development team and folks have been out beating the drum looking for support, and so far they've been able to find it. Now, whether or not they'll be able to sustain fundraising going forward if the strike continues, that's a very real and serious question. But at least to this point in the season, there hasn't been a dramatic fall off in gifts coming in, although there has been a huge fall off in ticket income, as you might well imagine. If you haven't played any concerts in 5 months, you're not going to make millions of dollars in ticket income. And so we are looking at a serious loss there.
I mean, Mark, do you think this actually brings up the idea that some orchestras have even grappled with the idea that perhaps if you make all the tickets free and just raise the balance of the money, could that be a model moving forward? What do you think about that? Could that work in Detroit, do you think, long term?
No, I don't.
How come?
The model has typically been about 70% of the income of this orchestra is raised through gifts from corporations, individuals, foundations, and the like, and money from the endowment. And then 30% is earned income. And I mean, 30% is 30%. The amount that you would have to raise for the endowment to make up for the 30% income from ticket sales would be humongous. I don't see any way in the short term that could happen.
So, I mean, you said that obviously they've raised a lot of money this season. Do you think that is showing a sign that that Detroiters want this orchestra to survive, that it really does mean something to them?
On some level, yeah, of course. There are people here who have always valued the orchestra and are willing to support it. The issue has been that we haven't been able here to sustain the high cost of the orchestra in this particular economy, over, and in particular here in Michigan, over the last 10 years or so. There have been systemic budget issues with this orchestra, and in many ways those issues go back 30 years here in Detroit. The issue is not that there aren't people here who value the institution and can pay for it. The issue is there are not enough of them.
But where do you think all these donors have been until now? I mean, if they were there and ready to support the orchestra in this time of kind of crisis or hiatus, where do you think they've been in the years before this?
Well, you have to understand that the number of people that many of the people that have given so far this year are people who have been giving to the orchestra over a number of years. So these are not new donors. There has been, over the last 5 months this year, a nice increase, an almost doubling of the number of donors to the institution from 1,500 to about 3,000. But the overall number of amount of money hasn't rapidly increased. So you have to assume then that many of these people are giving relatively modest amounts of money. And a lot of people giving a lot of money, giving a small amount of money, will bump up, you know, the pure numbers, but it's those major gifts that really push you ahead. So the formulas vary from year to year, and I don't think it's fair to say necessarily that, you know, well, where have all these people been? I mean, this is part of the churn of fundraising.
Okay. Am I right in thinking that there's like two distinct camps forming in Detroit, kind of people who support both sides of this very difficult situation? And for those who are kind of giving right now, does that kind of send a message that, the kind of an implicit message in that, that there's one side supporting management possibly than more of the orchestra, or are there not two sides in this?
I think when it comes to people who are giving money to the orchestra right now, I do not think that they are voting with their pocketbooks for management or for the players. I think they are voting in some ways for the institution of the Detroit Symphony for the future. Now, I think when you broaden out and you talk to people about the strike and the issues in the strike, then I think you have probably three different camps. I mean, you have people who support management and view the musicians as greedy and out of touch with the realities of running an orchestra in the 21st century. I think you then have a camp that looks at the situation and sees an evil management and an incompetent management and supports the players sort of wholeheartedly. And then I think you have a number of people who kind of sit there in the middle and the sort of pox on both your houses kind of attitude.
So if you can just encapsulate for us, you know, for those who are not as up to date with all the intricacies of this particular, I guess, conflict in Detroit between management and the union, where are we in the strike right now? What are the issues on the table, and where are both parties in that discussion?
And fundamentally, the issues today, 24 weeks into this strike, have not changed from day one. And that is that from management's perspective, they need to get a contract with the musicians that is sustainable over the long run, 5, 10, 20 years down the road, and that's creating a cost structure that this orchestra can afford through fundraising and through ticket sales. And they need to essentially take this institution from a $30 million institution annual budget down to about $25 million. By far the largest cost in running an orchestra, fixed cost, is the cost of musicians' salaries and benefits, which takes up about 50% of the budget in a major orchestra like the Detroit Symphony. So the orchestra management wants salary reductions of about, what's on the table right now is about 23%, from $104,000 annual minimum salary down to, say, the low 80s. And in addition to that, management wants to dramatically increase the outreach, education, chamber music, concerts, teaching, coaching, and the like that the players would do. And to do that demands restructuring the contract to partially redefine the way people, what people have do for their salary. So that, beyond playing orchestra concerts and rehearsals, it would be actually doing some education work, some outreach work, chamber music work. Okay, that's from management side. On the players' side, they look at those cuts that would of salary and the work rule changes, and they say that will fundamentally downgrade this institution from what has been traditionally a destination top 10 orchestra to a something resembling a regional orchestra that would become a stepping stone orchestra. That you simply can't, we cannot absorb those kinds of salary cuts and remain the kind of institution that we have been. And that essentially has been the argument from day one and remains the argument today.
Mark, thank you. I know we've got to wrap up our time with you, but I wanted to first of all thank you for your incredible reporting of this situation in Detroit and keeping us all informed in such a balanced and kind of a clear way. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Mark Stryker is the arts and entertainment reporter at the Detroit Free Press. He's been joining us from the newsroom at the Detroit Free Press. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you. It was good to be with you.
Thank you. This is a special podcast on WQXR.org. I'm Graham Parker, the Vice President of WQXR. The Detroit Symphony's season-long strike is the starkest reminder of the wrenching times facing many of America's 1,800 orchestras and their musicians. The Louisville Orchestra, the biggest in Kentucky, filed for bankruptcy in December. Its 110-year-old counterpart in Honolulu liquidated a year earlier. Other orchestras have posted major losses, even as they've reached new artistic heights. Joining us to discuss this is Jesse Rosen, the president and CEO of the League of American Orchestras, and Tim Kavanaugh, a senior editor at Reason Magazine, who covers the business of the arts. Welcome, Jesse, Tim.
Thanks, Graham.
So both
Thanks
of
very
you,
much. Nice to be here.
You're welcome. So you both heard Mark Stryker. I wanted to get your reactions, maybe first, Tim, from you.
I think it was a pretty good rundown of the situation, and I was interested to hear, you know, and in some ways maybe encouraged to hear that some excellent musicians are going on to, you know, lesser-known orchestras around the country. But that's, you know, it's a very typical situation. It's happening in a lot of orchestras around the country.
Jesse, your reaction?
Well, I thought Mark did a wonderful job of sizing up the situation there, and very fairly, as you said. I think the situation in Detroit, though, is unbelievably extreme, which isn't to say that there aren't challenges across the field, but the order of magnitude of challenge on both sides there, you know, the fundraising challenge that the orchestra is facing against that collapse in that economy, and the size of cut for musician salaries is at an order of magnitude so far beyond what has been asked for or negotiated in many other places around the country. So it's definitely an extreme case, and one can only hope that the parties come back together soon.
But Jesse, just to push on that a little bit, I mean, Detroit, it's as a city, has seen a huge amount of shift in the motor industry change and kind of the flight to the suburbs and just a dramatic demographic change in that city. I mean, can that city afford an orchestra anymore? I mean, does it need one?
Yeah. Well, you know, the difference between the management proposal and the union proposal has actually narrowed considerably. And the difference in dollars is not all that far apart. And I thought Mark's report of some form of a surge in support is an extremely encouraging sign that the community wants to have an orchestra there. And, you know, the question is, how much orchestra can they afford, and an orchestra of what kind? What's its role? What's its purpose? How does it participate in that community? These are all questions on the table in Detroit, and to some degree, these are the questions that are being addressed across the country.
I mean, Tim, I mean, Jesse does make a really good point that the situation in Detroit is quite unique and distinctive. And are there other cities, Tim, that you kind of look around the country as you write that you feel we could be having a similar conversation about another city in a few months? Anything like that you're seeing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that makes Detroit extreme is that it has had an extreme drawdown on its endowment. I mean, it's lost a lot of donors, and their endowment is about a fourth of what it was just a few years ago. But it's happening. I mean, you certainly saw a strike of the Columbus Orchestra in Ohio. You've seen the Shreveport Orchestra. I mean, there have been a lot of strikes. Seattle authorized a strike earlier this year. I think they didn't walk out. So you're seeing, you know, attempts to make these cuts everywhere in the country as a, you know, just as a result of the real economics that everybody is facing.
Staying with Detroit for a minute, President Obama was able to extract some significant concessions and changes to collective bargaining agreements from the motor unions in Detroit during 2008, you know, with significant concessions on benefit packages and other kind of annualized payments that often kind of can cause a union to, or a management to kind of find enormous amounts of money to pay unions. Do you think this model of change, of kind of dramatic changing of a collective bargaining agreement, is something that orchestra musicians should be looking at and be kind of taking some stock from the motor industry?
You may be right. I mean, the workers had no choice but to do it because they were looking at completely going out of business, and you're looking at the same thing with orchestras. So, yeah, I mean, you know, these have to be done in these forms of negotiations. But I really, you know, what's sad about this is that you have a chance to really revisit the whole model of performance and you know, really rethink how these things make money, how they draw audiences. And what we're talking about right now is really just, you know, some nipping, tucking around the edges rather than, you know, the kind of real doubling down you'd need to do about changing just your whole conception of what is, in fact, a pretty recent phenomenon historically. I mean, it's only the late 19th, early 20th century that the current model of symphony orchestra performance really solidified.
Yeah, so explain more what you mean. I mean, do you think there's a new model out there that we could be embracing, or has something dramatic got to change? Has a big orchestra got to go out of business like disappear, like the Philly Orchestra is rumoring funding for Chapter 11. Has something like the Philly Orchestra got to go away before this is going to get fixed?
Possibly, and I don't want to sound Pollyanna-ish or anything, but, you know, there are people trying new ways of doing performance, sometimes failing, sometimes succeeding. I'd suggest looking at a group called the Nouveau Classical Project right there in the Big Apple, where they perform all over town in sort of alternative venues in this kind of hybrid fashion show and performance. Alex Ross at the New Yorker covered some alternative types of performances at the Paris Bar, I think it is, where you actually go to a bar and hear an ensemble playing for you. You take a look at the Red Orchestra out of Cleveland, which actually I think they may have gone out of business, but they were trying a new model of newer music and different ways of getting audiences in there. I find it even ethically hard to support an organization that's only getting 30% of its income from people actually buying tickets to hear them play. I mean, you know, I'll leave it at that.
I mean, Jesse, just to bring you in to this exact point, what orchestras, I mean, you're in your bird's eye perch there as the head of the League of American Orchestras, what orchestras are you seeing who are confidently, boldly challenging the norm and having a go at defining what a new economic model looks like?
Well, you know, I think this is still kind of a frontier when it comes to what the new economic model is. And I think what I would say is that, first of all, most orchestras are not on the brink of extinction. So you see orchestras beginning to adapt by looking at their pricing structure. What does it cost to go to a concert? They're looking at the venues they play and to what extent are the venues a barrier to participation. They're looking at their own, you know, the local ecology and the arts marketplace that they inhabit. Now, there's a whole other discussion, and Tim is getting at this, and it's a fascinating and terribly important one, which is how do orchestras evolve as a musical enterprise in today's world? Because, you know, completely apart from the recession we're in a period of tremendous upheaval in terms of the way people participate in arts and entertainment and cultural events. And on one level, that poses a great threat. And we see that manifested in, you know, less attendance sometimes. But also the challenge here is to find out, so where are they going? What are people doing? The internet offers tremendous potential distribution, as we're beginning to see now through LA's project, through the theaters like the Met has been doing. All kinds of opportunities are out there for repositioning the orchestra, both in terms of what it does, how it serves its community, as well as how it derives revenue. And I think we have a lag. I think what I would say is I see orchestras making great strides in terms of what they do on stage, what they do in their communities, what they do with technology. We haven't yet figured out how to monetize that and how do we derive revenue from some of that activity. So that I think that's where the big opportunity is for orchestras.
I mean, Tim, as we think about the kind of the evolving ecology for American orchestras, it's helpful to just go back a few weeks and remember what Rocco Landsman, the chairman of the National Endowment of the Arts, he certainly stirred up a hornet's nest when he said in a speech, there are too many theaters making too little money. He added, it will all come to a head one day. So, Tim, are there too many orchestras, and should some of them just be let to let go?
Well, it's something about Rocco Landsman's comments. I mean, it was interesting and provocative, you know, and it's refreshing to hear it brought up. I know everybody considers it philistine to talk about classical performance in the same way you talk about the market for wedding bands, but, you know, if we can discuss supply and demand in the context of sex and marriage and dating, I think we can talk about it in the context of orchestral performance, too. That having been said, Rocco Landsman, you know, he's had an impressive career in for-profit theater, but right now he is an official sitting in Washington, and if some apparatchik in D.C. declared that the economy had too many airplanes or it had too many iPads, we'd say that's silly. How the hell does he know? And so, you know, I don't think he is in a position to say what the correct shape or size of the theater market throughout the United States should be, and I don't know that. Having said that, I will refrain from deciding whether we have too many orchestras or not in the United States. I mean, it's nice to have that many out there, and I think with enough experimentation and evolution, you're going to see that survive, and people continue to play beautiful music, and audiences continue to be pleased by it.
Jesse, I mean, before you ran the League of American Orchestra, you ran a very well-respected American Composers Orchestra here in New York, and WQX, obviously based here in New York, let's turn for a second at the landscape and the marketplace right around us here at our studios. You know, when you think about the Westchester Philharmonic, the Long Island Philharmonic, we've lost the Queen Symphony, we've lost the Staten Island Philharmonic, the Brooklyn Phil kind of goes through a up and down kind of roller coaster ride of are they here, aren't they here? In New York, do we need this many orchestras?
Well, I think, Graham, you probably know as well as I do, the orchestras in New York are extremely well differentiated for the most part. And so, you know, what you find are orchestras like the ACO, which is smaller than it used to be. But the niche, the need for an orchestra devoted to introducing new American music, that need hasn't gone away. So that orchestra is still very much there. And we see similarly with St. Luke's. New York City needs an orchestra that's available for all of the choruses, its series, its chamber, the whole thing. So with a little orchestra society dedicated only to doing educational work. So I think the differentiation is what gives some very strong legitimacy to the number of orchestras we have in the city. But again, I'd go back to what I said before, which is that there is a, you know, some degree of resilience that we're seeing in Brooklyn as it's now trying to, you know, once again reinvent itself, is I think on a path that seems very exciting and very promising. This notion that they don't want to be a smaller version of the New York Philharmonic, but in Brooklyn, they want to be an orchestra that derives its artistic inspiration from the neighborhoods of Brooklyn. And when you think about Brooklyn neighborhoods, they are extraordinarily rich and colorful in history and people. And it's a way of linking that orchestra's value very closely to the place it comes from. And so to me, it's a very, very promising development in New York City. So I completely agree with Tim. Too many, too few. We live in a free market society. The ones that can't survive won't survive, and the ones who do. And, you know, we don't have a plan, a master plan to determine how many we should have.
But, Jesse, I mean, this is interesting for you to say. I mean, you are acknowledging that maybe Rocco Landsman might be right, that, in fact, there might be some orchestras who will naturally go by the wayside because either their marketplace, their local environment, the philanthropic community just can't support them. And you think that's okay?
I would be disappointed if that happened. And I think everybody would. I think the first thing any organization goes through if they're losing market is to figure out how do we adapt to our changed market conditions. And that's the opportunity orchestras have. And if they can't do that, then okay. Then if no one wants to come and no one wants to write you checks to support you, then you're just not going to be. But I think what we need to turn our attention to is how do we do this adaptive work? How do we adjust to where our market is going? How do we become meaningful in today's world with an art form that has its life, you know, it's old stuff. So it has to be made fresh again. So,
I mean, Tim, Jesse was right to mention kind of changing media landscapes. And while we're staying on the NEA via Rocco Landsman, the NEA in 2010 published a really interesting report about media use and the arts. And, you know, half of the adult population, 118 million Americans, access the arts through some kind of digital portal, whether it be a mobile phone or the internet or streaming or whatever it may be. Tim, do you think that those of us in classical music have just got to embrace digital technology and mobile technology as the way forward, or is that just a blip that we'll go through at some point?
Yes, is my answer.
Beautifully noncommittal.
It is clear that there are ever new avenues for listening, for dissemination. From a consumer point of view, we're absolutely in the best of all possible worlds, right? There's more people playing live for you to choose from, and there are certainly more avenues to listen to whatever you want to listen to, not have to listen to whatever you've been programmed for, and so that's terrific. On the other hand, we can't ignore what they call in economics the Baumol effect, which is the fixed costs that really can't be changed by changes in technology or productivity. I think those may be a little bit overstated in the symphony orchestra world, but they are certainly very, very strong in the symphony orchestra world. These are people who, you know, devote their lives to this career. It takes years and years to get up to a professional level. You have to start early in life. So to some degree, there isn't much play around how much a musician gets paid, and there's nothing you can do around that. Again, though, I think with more, and I don't want to use flexibility as this euphemism for just paying people less, but if there is more flexibility on where you perform, how much you charge for a ticket, and I don't necessarily think prices need to go up. I mean, sometimes you're going to fill more seats by lowering your ticket prices, and it's not an inexpensive night out to go see a symphony orchestra. But as you see, you know, more flexibility about where you play and what kind of audiences you draw and building up new audiences, you will maybe get some play in that.
I mean, Tim, just pushing you on a little bit on that. I mean, you talk about flexibility, but, you know, musicians might say, well, flexibility equals dilution of their art and their craft. Is that appropriate, that they need to embrace that kind of dilution? Or do you think flexibility means something entirely different?
You know, it wasn't a dilution in the art when Haydn, was trying to get everybody out for the summer break, when Prince Esterhazy was forcing everybody to stay around and play more concerts, right? I mean, there's...
Right, the greatest work stoppage symphony of all time, the Farewell Symphony.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's true. Obviously, if you have to, you know, work 12 hours a day and turn out a lot, there's probably going to be some suffering in the product that you're putting out, but not that much. And these are professional people, and I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but, you know, writing for a living is fairly easy work too, but playing music for a living has got to be up there in the top 5 or 10 of dream jobs.
Right. I mean, Jesse, do you think kind of encouragement of more kind of flexible ensembles and doing more things on media, do things on YouTube, is that changing the image of classical music? Is it diluting it? Is that flexibility also, are we kind of flying in the face of that stuffy kind of don't touch it way of thinking about classical music, or is it entirely appropriate that this image is confronted and changed kind of right now?
I think this is one of those both and situations. I heard a concert of the Philadelphia Orchestra last week in Carnegie Hall. They played Tchaikovsky 5 with Dutoit. And you just want that ensemble to be here for a long time and play that well. And there's something extraordinary about the way an orchestra sounds, all 100 players, that ensemble, that size, in a body of repertoire that's extremely well aligned with, you know, with that instrument. And the care and feeding of an ensemble like that, we need those. We want them. They have to be with us. At the same time, there's plenty of room for all the other things that orchestras are being called upon to think about and to work on, whether it's being more present online, on the internet, more forms of distribution digitally, whether it is as in Memphis, where the musicians of the orchestra are curating their own series in blues clubs and performing in those clubs. Or I was in Chicago last week, and there's a big gala, but the composer in residence wasn't there. She was in prison doing a composition workshop. The other composer in residence is a DJ who was in a club. So both things need to be part of what orchestras are about. And thankfully, I don't think we have to choose. I think we can have both.
I mean, Jesse, just staying with you for a second, I mean, you mentioned the Philadelphia Orchestra and, you know, an amazing account of Tchaik 5, but why are they facing such perilous future right now? They are burning through their endowment. I hear their cash reserves are perilously low, and their chairman last week talked about filing for Chapter 11. What's the disconnect here? What's incongruous between playing a great piece of solid repertoire and maybe not surviving another season?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that orchestras are coming to learn and experience is that quality is coming to have a broader definition. And so I'll give you a very vivid example, maybe not a perfect one, but I was in Miami at the opening of the new Frank Gehry building for the New World Symphony. And Howard Herring, who's the president of the orchestra, gave me and we had our whole board down there, gave us a tour of the hall. And after an hour going through this brand new concert hall, Howard never once said the word acoustics. Now, in our business, and when you talk about concert halls, we talk about acoustics as the primary fundamental thing that matters more than anything else. So here's an hour-long tour of a brand-new building, not a word about acoustics. the commentary was about the way the hall operated as a creative partner with the music making, about how the hall was a center for people to come and congregate, how the hall functioned to allow the public in, and how the hall functioned to allow the music to be projected out on this big HD screen. And so quality, which we used to imagine was the most high-level execution of a performance in the most acoustically perfect space, is now growing to include a whole range of other considerations having to do really more with how the public experiences the music as opposed to how wonderfully we produce it and execute it. It's been a great area of growth for our field. And I think in Philadelphia, I think part of the learning there is there's a period of time where that orchestra was very focused on the quality of what happened on the stage and to some degree neglectful of these other dimensions of quality that really serve to engage a community and make it feel that the orchestra is a real partner and a contributor to the community. I think that could have something to do with why they are where they are.
Great. Just a last question to you both. Tim, I want to start with you. I mean, we've certainly heard from Mark about difficult situations in Detroit, and we've had a chat here with both you and Jesse Rosen about the kind of difficult state of the landscape for American orchestras. I just wanted to kind of turn it 180 degrees. Tim, what makes you so excited about the future for American orchestras?
I think that we're, you know, we it's not even clear that we should be using this term classical music, which actually, you know, as we all, I'm sure, know for WQXR listeners, refers to a specific period of music and doesn't include a lot. I think we're, you know, you're seeing much more of a reexamination of what is it that people want to hear, and you're seeing more, you know, it's taken Lord knows long enough to get even, you know, a lot of the 20th century repertoire into regular performance, but I think that's starting to change a lot. You know, out in LA, you've had two in a row for the LA Philharmonic have had really exciting conductors that people got really interested in seeing. Now, I don't know that the Dudamel model of, you know, this sort of Venezuelan system of, you know, farm leaguing kids is really the future, and all of it done at public expense. But I think you're starting to see more of a sense of you need to talk to people. So I think you're seeing, you know, a revisitation to say, the way things were done in Mahler's time, when, you know, a symphony was an hour and a half or 2 hours long, and there were, you know, as he writes it, a symphony for 1,000, that's not the only way to do business.
And Jesse, what excites you and continues you kind of doing what you do every single day? What brightens the future for American orchestras?
I guess two things. One is creatively. I think orchestras really are kind of at a high point now, and there are many things we could point to. One, right here in New York, Alan Gilbert, I think, is doing a sensational job as the music director at the Philharmonic, and you know, one sign of that was this wonderful series of concerts he did last spring, the Ligeti Le Grand Macabre, which was kind of a milestone, not just because it was an important piece to do in New York, but it was a very hard piece to do in New York and a hard piece to get an audience for. And the Philharmonic really kind of turned itself inside out and upside down to represent itself to New York City public in a new and very different way. And they used the internet very creatively to do that. And they took a program that was selling very poorly to selling out three shows. And a lot of the people who were there were new, young, there for the first time. And it was a sensational piece of music. So there are many, many examples of what's happening creatively. But in another vein, I would say, and this goes to the point I made earlier about the what do we understand to stand for quality today. I was in New Orleans a couple of years ago, just before the orchestra was about to move back into its hall after being out of it for 4 years after Katrina. And I met with, I think, the 10 musicians who are on their board. And this was before a concert. And I asked them how they felt having been out for 4 years, and they must be excited to be going back to their new hall. And they said, well, you know, it really wasn't that bad. And I said, well, you know, you've been playing in churches and schools and gyms and, you know, not good acoustical environments. And they said, well, you know, when we couldn't see the conductor because of sight lines, we just listened a lot better. And when we couldn't hear because the acoustics were so horrible, we looked a lot more closely. And I said, actually, the adverse conditions helped us to actually play better during that period. But then they said, more importantly, they said, when we played in these venues, something changed about what took place in the concerts. They said, we could actually see the people's faces while we were playing. And we could see that what we were doing was making a difference. And when we saw that, we played differently. We drew inspiration from that kind of contact that we had with the public, which we don't usually have in our main hall. So then I said, well, so now you're about to go back into that hall. What's that like for you? And they said, well, you know, we don't any longer think of that as our home. That's now one of our homes, but we're going to continue the relationships that we started in these neighborhoods all around New Orleans. And that orchestra is a very unique relationship to its community. The first public performances after Katrina were given by the Louisiana Philharmonic. So the first time people came out to be together was at orchestra concerts. And not surprisingly, the first capital arts project after Katrina was the restoration of their concert hall. So it enjoys a place of pride in that city, and not just because of good community relations, but it's inextricably bound up with how they understand their sense of quality as a symphony orchestra.
Great. This has been a special podcast on WQXR.org. I'm Graham Parker, the Vice President of WQXR. My guests have been Jesse Rosen, the President and CEO of the League of American Orchestras, and Tim Kavanaugh, a Senior Editor at Reason Magazine, who covers the business of the arts. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Graham.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Thank you.